Hello, everyone, and welcome to another podcast for the Open UK. Today, we are joined by Adrian Woodhead. Adrian, how are you doing today?
Pretty good in yourself.
Good, good. And so, Adrian, I like to start these podcasts and these discussions with maybe just a little introduction of yourself. Tell the listeners a little about you and what you do on a day-to-day basis and maybe how you got into the open source space.
Sure. So, yeah, I mean, many moons ago, I studied computer science, and then I worked for a variety of different companies, started off doing multimedia, content management, digital rights management. And then where sort of my love affair with open source began, in between paid jobs working for companies, I tried to do two startups with friends of mine. And as part of doing that, we built a lot of the startup tech on open source technology. And one of the things we needed to do, it was just sort of a side effect of what we were doing, was like a little encryption module. And I decided to open source that because it was kind of like, I figured we're using so much open source, we should try give something back where we can. So that got me really interested in just how all of that works, the collaboration, the sharing, etc. And then I worked for a while. I did some volunteer work for an organization called Geek Corps. So they would like send geeks out into developing countries to work on projects. And all of that was open source. And then I went back for working for a company. I worked at a big music, well, started off as a small music startup, but it became a big one. It was called Last.fm. And they also open sourced a lot of what they created. So then that became really interesting, actually doing that as part of your day job, being able to do that. So again, it was just a nice side effect that was something we were allowed to do and able to do there. And again, it was, you know, contributing back to a big wealth of software community that we as a company were taking advantage of too.
Yeah. And, you know, taking a step back, so it's interesting. So you mentioned that you would be sent out to developing countries. What countries did you visit and what sort of work did you do?
Yeah, so Geek Corps had a number of different projects and generally you'd be assigned to one. So I did sort of one tour of duty. It was 3 months. So I got sent to South Africa where at one of the universities in the Western Cape, they had a project where they were developing an open source sort of e-learning platform. And there were two sides to it. So one was the idea, which is contributing code to this platform, which was open source. And the other was what they call capacity building. So it was working with developers at the university and teaching them.
And
I actually think that was the biggest impact I had. Like the code I contributed was fine, but I think the biggest impact was actually working side by side with these developers, teaching them, you know, sharing my knowledge with them, etc. And then I know one of them's gone on to do a PhD and another one got headhunted and got by Microsoft and has moved to Seattle. So I think that's quite a good outcome for the two of them.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, that's always, you know, there's that sense of pride when you help someone grow their career and accomplish something even greater.
Indeed.
And I know that's something that, you know, we talked briefly before this chat, and you had actually gotten to know the Open UK through the, you know, kids competition that they ran on the tech side of things. And so maybe tell us a little bit about that, because that's a really interesting story as well.
Yeah, so one of the things I've noticed being in the software industry for so long, obviously there's the big gender divide with it being very male dominated. And even when just trying to hire software developers for teams I've worked on, the number of female applicants was just, you know, 1 in 20 maybe even less. So, you know, we did a lot of looking into this at my previous job, which was at the Expedia Group. And, you know, one of the pieces of research they did was just looking at applicants leaving university with a computer science degree. And I think in the UK, it's something like 17%. So already your pool of people who've studied computer science in terms of being able to get a female developer is like 1 in 5. So that's already, you know, not 50-50. And then if you, you know, if you want to get people to study computer science, you need to go back to the schooling system. And why is it that girls aren't choosing to study computer science? So that really sparked my interest in teaching kids how to code. And hopefully, you know, being able to get young girls really interested in coding at a much earlier level. And then that was around the same time when Open UK were launching their kids competition. So I got really interested in, you know, how is that being promoted? How are schools using it? You know, what's the sort of gender numbers of the kids taking part in the competition? And that was really encouraging because there were a lot of girls and a lot of boys, and they were all having a lot of fun, all doing really good work. So as a judge, I saw that and I found that heartening. And it was like, yes, we can do this. It's going to take, you know, 10 years to make a difference, but I think we can by encouraging more stuff like this.
And so you've continued that. You've done some other coding camps and some other things as outreach even recently, right?
Yeah, so at Expedia, we had a very good internship program. So there we had a number of female developers, I think, on my team over the course of about 4 years. We had four. And that was really good because part of the program was getting the intern to contribute to an open source project. So they had a bit of a, you know, a CV that they could show off at the end of the internship. It wasn't just internal code that no one would ever be able to see. So they would leave the internship and be like, hey, look, I contributed to these projects. So that would be great for their future career. We also, wherever possible, we tried to get the work to be on a project that we could then have them present at an international conference. So I think that's also a really good thing, like role models. Like if women can see other women giving talks at like a really high level, we were hoping that would be a motivating thing. So that was good. Those were really amazing projects. I was very proud and happy to be part of them. And then, you know, my own personal life, I've been teaching a code club at my daughter's primary school. And there again, the division, it's about 50-50 girls and boys, all very interested and capable. And there I've been using some of the stuff that Open UK have launched. You know, last year they distributed several thousand microbits to various schools across the UK. And there's a curriculum around that about teaching kids to code, you know, programming the microbit to do various things.
Well, it's good because when you started and you started talking about this, how it was 1 in 5 or 1 out of 20, and now you're teaching classes that have a 50-50 split almost. That's progress.
Definitely.
You know, and that's good. And it's personal, and it's good to be able to teach your own, you know, daughter, right? That's always special. I have a daughter who's 21 now. You know, so I've gone through a lot of that back and forth with her. But so it is a special thing where you can not only help, you know, the ecosystem, but also help, you know, someone you care about so much. So that's awesome. That's very awesome. Now, you mentioned you worked at Expedia as well. And, you know, from there, you went to a company called Human Security. Mm-hmm. And so for those who listened to the Open UK podcast recently, we've been doing a lot on security. So, you know, security is always a hot topic. So maybe tell us a little bit about what you're doing at Human Security now.
Yeah, so Human Security, its main focus up to now has been botnet detection and mitigation. So looking at ways that cyber criminals perform fraud using, you know, massive networks of thousands or even hundreds of thousands of computers. A lot of what they've done has been in the advertising space. So where cyber fraud is committed by, you know, selling fake eyeballs, you know, having big botnets view adverts and then selling that advertising to people. Advertisers pay money, but no humans actually ever see the adverts. It's just bots. But recently the company's also made some acquisitions. So they've expanded their remit. They're also looking at, you know, where botnets are also used to do things like commit listening fraud, streaming fraud. So, you know, an artist on Spotify, for example, could pay a cyber criminal of some sort to inflate their listening stats. You also have things like account takeovers, you know, bots trying to, you know, guess passwords and then take over accounts and use them to do all kinds of things. Another thing that we look at is what's called malvertising. It's a bit of a weird term, but it's basically where cyber criminals will use an ad network to distribute an advert, but the advert itself might contain things like malicious JavaScript that'll look for weaknesses in an operating system to be able to inject malware into it. And then that operating system can then be used in a future botnet to do something else. So these are kind of all the areas that we operate in.
Okay. Yeah. And honestly, this is interesting because it's very newsworthy right now with everything that's happening in some of the social media places. There's a lot of discussion on, you know, how many users do a lot of these platforms have versus are actually just bot driven, mm-hmm. and how many followers are people getting, or likes, you know, retweets, YouTube views, whatever. How many are real versus how many are fake?
Exactly.
This is an interesting area because there's also been a lot of like TV shows, movies, and things that I've seen, documentaries on this, where, you know, people have tried to just create influencers just by using these bots and have varying degrees of success. And I think similarly, you know, with, you know, you mentioned the music space, other places, this can be, you know, a pretty big part of the internet. One of the other things that I often have had to do is look at, you know, download metrics for open source software and bring this back to open source. Sometimes half, sometimes even more than half of the downloads are done by bots, you know, that are out there. And these aren't necessarily even malicious bots necessarily, but they're out there, you know, maybe, you know, going through crawling things, pulling, you know, software down to archive it, do whatever. There's a lot of bots out there.
Yeah. And exactly, that's a really good point. Like, not all bots are bad. There are plenty of good bots. I mean, we try not to make a good bad decision. So there are various ways you can classify them. So those more useful bots, we kind of categorize them as safe bots. So, you know, for our customers, if we see bot activity on their website or application, whatever it is, we can say, what we aim to be able to say to them is like, is this a bot or is it a human? And if it is a bot, is it a safe bot or is it some type of a malicious bot? Because, you know, as you just said, they're not all bot activity is bad. A lot of it is very useful. There are a lot of automated programs out there that, you know, ensure the internet is kept up and running. And that's very different from someone abusing your platform in some way.
And these kind of fall into two categories, right? So you have bots that violate terms of service, that aren't necessarily trying to maliciously take down or infect people, but they are swaying influence. And then you've got, like you said, malicious adverts or malicious software trying to be distributed through these bots, through these advertising networks or other things. Do you have any sort of idea, like, you know, what is that kind of like split? Are there more that are just kind of maybe the ones that are that are just the influencer side versus the actual malicious side? Or do we see that both are kind of equal?
Yeah, I think it's very hard to know the exact number. So I'm afraid I can't really give an answer.
Okay.
I mean, there's a lot of activity on both sides, and it also changes all the time. You know, these malicious actors and networks come and go, and then they resurface in different forms. And sometimes you'll even find that the same groups, you know, they might be using something like advertising fraud to generate revenue. And then they use that revenue to fund a different kind of botnet that's doing, you know, misinformation or trying to do, you know, swing an election or something. So they're all intertwined. So that's, you know, one of the ideologies that the founders of Human sort of had was, if you can stop the revenue streams, you stop all kinds of other malicious activity that is being funded by these revenue streams.
Ah, okay. And that makes sense. And, you know, especially when a lot of the internet's still driven by advertising revenue, right? It's very easy to potentially game that system.
Yeah. And I mean, that's exactly the thing. Like, why a lot of cyber criminals do what they do is money. I mean, some of them are driven by ideology or nation states. There are lots of reasons. but a lot of them are just in it for the money. And yeah, if you follow the money, obviously there's e-commerce, there's banking, all those kinds of things. But advertising is a huge, huge part of the sort of economics of the internet. So that's a prime place for these kinds of actors to get involved and try, you know, skim money off wherever they can.
Yeah, definitely. So as you've started to, you know, get deeper into the security space, what are some of the trends that you see kind of popping up or things that you or your company are starting to be more worried or concerned about?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think what I've noticed, as this wasn't really my specialty area before getting involved a couple of years ago, it's something I've always been interested in, but not something I've done day to day, is just the variety of attacks, just how many different types of attacks, and everywhere along the chain from, like, you know, in the advertising space, from just like producing malicious adverts for to the buying and selling of them, to the fake eyeballs, to, you know, whether it's in the programmatic space or taking over people's browsers, to mobile apps, to connected televisions. Like, I've just been amazed at how prevalent it is, just at every step in the supply chain. And also outside of the advertising space, it's just everywhere. And also the different levels you've got. Like, you've got, you know, kind of the stereotypical script kiddies who are just playing around, you know, causing a bit of havoc and, you know, seeing what they can do. But then how the more advanced malicious actors are just so organized, you know, they have teams of people working, you know, they use the same tools that us as software developers used to create issues. They seem to work in agile. They add features to their botnets and their attacks. They adapt very quickly. So the sophistication of some of these groups and the sort of normal software practices that they follow is pretty concerning. And I had no idea that they were this organized and this, you know, prevalent.
Now, with the background, and I mean, you've got years and years of experience in the open source space. What about, you know, security in the open source space specifically? You know, having that background in open source, even if it's, you know, just more recently on the security side, are there things that you see in the open source space that we could do a better job?
Yes. So that's excellent question. So, and that actually ties into something that Human does. So one of the founders of Human Security was a person called Dan Kaminsky, and he was very big and in the cybersecurity space. And he was, I never met him personally, but I've heard a lot about him. And he was very big at sharing his knowledge and, you know, speaking at conferences and encouraging the open source community to, you know, fix security vulnerabilities and so on. So he passed away, I think about a year and a half ago. And the other founders of the company decided to honor his memory by creating a fellowship. And what the fellowship aims to do is to sponsor a person or a group for a year in doing something that makes the internet a better, safer place.
Okay.
That's quite broad, but the idea there is exactly that. It's like looking at open source projects or, you know, various other organizations or groups on the internet that could benefit in some way from improving their security posture at a very high level. So the first fellow that we had over the last year, his name is Jonathan Lightshoe, and what he's been working on is a project that looks for vulnerabilities in open source projects. And then what it also does is it doesn't just alert the maintainers like, hey, we found a vulnerability in your project. It also attempts to fix those vulnerabilities.
Oh, really? Huh.
So there's a certain class of vulnerability that you can actually, like, A, scan for, and B, automatically fix. So what this does, so a very simple example in how he started out was there's a way of distributing software that a lot of Java projects use called Maven. Mm-hmm. And when you refer to like a Maven repository, initially a lot of the URLs were HTTP URLs. So these days it's much, you know, the best practice is to use HTTPS, of course. So this is just a very simple example, but you could scan for repositories that are referring to Maven using HTTP, and you can just change those to HTTPS. So that's a simple one to find and fix. One of the challenges is when he did this, he found like thousands of projects that had this. So as a, you know, person manually going and raising, you know, 5,000 pull requests, that's going to take you a lot of time. So he also built a framework that would bulk generate pull requests. So that's what he's been doing in the fellowship year, is looking at other categories of issues that can be detected and fixed, and then raising bulk pull requests across all of them. So the idea there is to make it much easier for maintainers of open source projects to accept pull requests that fix vulnerabilities in their projects.
Oh, very cool. Very cool. Now, I know not only the open source space, but you've been doing a lot of data, right? So your background also has been on the big data space, you know, ingesting and handling a lot of data. And there is a lot of data out in the ecosystem now. More data is known about me now than ever before. My data is always hacked, by the way. You know, I don't know about you, but I've got a lot of free credit monitoring. I actually have enough for my daughter will inherit free credit monitoring for the rest of her life and maybe my grandchildren's life eventually, right?
Congratulations.
Yes, yes. Thank you. Because I've been hacked so much, right? My information's out there so many times. And then everybody that does it gives me the free 3 years of credit monitoring. But it, with the rise of, you know, this insatiable need for data, whether it's in the open space or proprietary data that people are collecting on you, what are your thoughts on data security and keeping that data secure and safe? And have we reached a point where maybe there's just too much data out there?
Yeah, and that's something that definitely concerns me. You know, every time you sign up with anyone and give them any data about yourself, you're opening yourself up for risk. And I mean, obviously, it depends. You know, most organizations, you're probably just giving them your name and email address and maybe a few other bits. Obviously, your date of birth starts leaking out all over the show. And it's a really hard one because you have to think about how trustworthy is this organization with all of their security practices. And like you say, you know, every week there's another data breach that comes out and, you know, all of us have had our data hacked multiple times. You know, and I think, you know, there's legislation like GDPR and various other things that have been enacted over the past couple of years that aim to, you know, get some guidelines around this and make organizations think more carefully about what they keep. And I think most importantly, limit how long they keep things for. Now, it used to be like everyone would just keep everything forever. But at least that kind of legislation and similar acts have made people think more about actually, let's not keep this forever. Let's expire data or at least get rid of certain parts of the data over time. So I think that's a really good thing. It's just really, really hard to police these kinds of things. Like, you know, I've been in organizations where we've been audited and, you know, it takes a lot of time and effort, and the auditors themselves have to have a lot of knowledge and a lot of expertise to be able to sort of trace data through an organization, all the different touch points, where it gets stored, how it gets stored, you know, encryption, password hygiene, salts, all these kinds of things. Like, it's not easy. You have to have a fair amount of knowledge. And another thing is there are just not enough people who have this kind of knowledge, which makes it even harder.
Yeah. I mean, and this is a very human issue as well, right? So a lot of security issues, in my experience, whether it's data leaks, whether it's actual, like, you know, hacks, end up being driven by maybe that lack of skill set, right? Mm-hmm. Or lack of knowledge. There's a lot of software out there. There's a lot of services out there. There's, and let's be honest, applications are getting more complex because there's just so many more components. And each one of them, if you don't configure it correctly, if you don't understand quite how to store the data, you know, properly, you don't, you know, necessarily know how to set it up, or you just trust that some third party on the internet's going to just keep your data safe for you. All of those things can really lead towards potential issues from a security perspective.
Yeah, indeed. So I guess two things there. So I know when I studied computer science, like, we didn't cover security at all.
Yeah.
It wasn't even a thing that you could study. But what I am seeing now with students who are graduating and are applying for internships is a lot of them have a cybersecurity module as part of their degrees. So that's good. I've even noticed some high schools, when they're teaching, you know, coding to kids, they mention cybersecurity. So I think that's good, and hopefully that's a trend that we see more of. And it should just be a base part of a computer science curriculum, or anyone involved in tech is just to have some basic knowledge of these things. The other point you mentioned there about the complexity of software these days, and the fact that an application is built of so many different components, and you have this whole supply chain, and, you know, the components that you build on refer to other components, et cetera, et cetera. And that's something that I know there's been a lot of interest in within OpenUK. You know, there's working groups who are looking at these software bill of materials, which is one way of being able to sort of codify, like, I've got a piece of software, and these are the other pieces of software I depend on, and then in turn, they depend on these pieces of software. And ideally, you can kind of have a map of everything that comes into your application and the versions of it. And then, you know, if there is a vulnerability, you know, you could then do a scan, like, okay, version X of this piece of software is vulnerable. Let me look at my software bill of materials. Do I depend on that piece of software? Yes, I do. Is it a vulnerable version? Yes, it is. And that'll be a way that you can more easily react to a vulnerability and hopefully fix it.
Awesome. Well, Adrian, I want to thank you for taking some time to chat with us today, share a little bit about your background, share a little bit about, you know, the security space. It was great chatting with you.
Likewise. Very happy to have been here.
Thank you, everybody, for listening in. And don't forget to like, subscribe, and follow us on your favorite podcast app.